Welcome back to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry. Here's your host, Brother Robert Johnson.
This is episode 366. In the news this week, not a whole lot going on as usual. I did get a tip that the Grand Lodge of Russia is sanctioning a lodge in Syria. Not entirely sure on the dynamics of that, but I'm sure we'll be hearing more soon. Just kind of interesting. In other news, I was asked to do a how to tie a bow tie video from the Grand Lodge of Massachusetts. Some guys know, some guys don't know. I am a plural member of Ezekiel Bates Lodge in Attleboro, Massachusetts. I joined there after going to present a few years in a row at the Masonic Con event, and so I did this video, and I hope you guys check it out. It's on our YouTube channel. It's being used to also promote the Grand Master's bow tie. So the Grand Lodge has this bow tie, and all of the proceeds go to helping those people who are less fortunate than ourselves. So if you check that out and you like it, then follow the link, get one of those bow ties, and help out. So we're going to continue our trend from last week. I've got a couple pieces this week, and we'll go ahead and get into that in just a moment. The Whence Came You podcast is brought to you through the generous support of Masonic Revival, contemporary Masonic designs made for today's Freemason. You don't have to settle for throwing a plain old square and compass on anything anymore. Now you get something truly designed and truly wonderful. Whether it's aprons, awesome pins, and wonderful neckwear, bow ties, ties, pocket squares, you name it, Masonic Revival has it. Head on over to MasonicRevival.com and check out what they have to offer, and make sure if you see Brother Edgar, tell him thanks for helping bring this program to all of you. And this program is also brought to you by all of you, those of you who support this program. We can't do it without you and your donations and all of your assistance, so thank you so much. To find out more about how you can assist this program, head on over to WCYpodcast.com and click on Support the Show. There you can make direct donations, sign up to be a monthly contributor, a fellow, or even a producer. And thanks very much to everybody for donating. So the piece I'd like to focus on this week is the continuation of what we started last week, which was the Mother Grand Lodge Part 1. What I'm about to read comes from January 1929 and is the Mother Grand Lodge Part 2. This was reprinted by the permission of the MSA, or the Masonic Services Association of America, and again from 1929. Let's go ahead and get started. Of the few lodges at London, as the record puts it, who constituted themselves a Grand Lodge in 1717, only four are named. If other lodges were invited, it may be surmised that they either had not been notified of the purpose of the meeting, or if so, that they had declined to associate themselves with its undertaking. Or perhaps no one knew what was afoot when the meeting was held, and the idea of a Grand Lodge was born of the spirit of the hour. The phrase time immemorial, used to denote the age of the four lodges taking part, is all a blur, telling us no authentic story on their history. On the engraved list of lodges, 1729, the Goose and Gridiron Lodge No. 1, known after as the Lodge of Antiquity, is said to have dated from 1691. Of the others, we have no early knowledge at all, except the part they took in the founding of the first Grand Lodge. Even the Lodge of Antiquity pursued an uneventful career until Preston became its master in 1774, when it was involved in a dispute with Grand Lodge. The lodge which met at the Crown Ale House, Parker's Lane No. 2 of the original four, played no part in Masonic history, and died of initiation 20 years later, stricken off the roll in 1740. No Mason of any note seems to have belonged to it. The Apple Tree Tavern, Lodge No. 3, gave the Grand Lodge its first Grand Master, Anthony Sayer, who apparently appointed two members of his own lodge as Grand Wardens, so at least we may conjecture. The lodge moved to Queenshead, Knaves Acre, about 1723, and, if we may believe Anderson, it was loath to come under the new constitution adopted in that year. These two lodges seem to have been operative lodges, or largely so, composed of working masons and brethren of the artisan class. Clearly, then, the new Grand Lodge was made up of predominantly operative masons and not, as has so often been implied, the design of men who simply made use of the remnants of operative masonry, the better to exploit some hidden cult. Still, it may be argued that even if operative masons were in the majority, the real leadership of the movement came from the accepted masons. And that is quite true. But anyone who knows that the ingrained conservatism of masons of every sort will be slow to admit that any designing group could have imposed anything not inherently Masonic upon such an assembly. The premier lodge of the period, which seems to have initiated and led the formation and policy of the new Grand Lodge, was number 4, meeting at the Rumor and Grape Tavern in Channel Row, Westminster. It was almost entirely a speculative lodge made up of accepted masons and almost all the leading men of the craft. In that formative tune were members of it. The other lodges, and perhaps 20 members each, while number 4 had a roll of 70, among them men of high social rank, including members of nobility. Had it not been for such a lodge, the only one of its kind and quality in London, the chances are many that no Grand Lodge would have been formed. And the story of our craft, if it had had a story at all, would have been very different. Besides Dr. Anderson, to whom Gould says we may safely attribute the authorship of the Constitution as well as much else, some of it rather fantastic, and Dr. Desaguliers, to whom tradition ascribes the refashioning of much of the ritual, the second and third Grand Masters were men of that lodge. It also furnished a Grand Secretary, William Cowper. The lodge continued to hold first place in numbers, social rank, and influence until 1735, when a decline set in, both in attendance and contributions, and in 1747 it was decreed that the lodge, quote-unquote, be erased from the Book of Lodges, end quote. 4 years later, the lodge was restored, but it never regained its former power, and 20 years later appeared to be once more on the edge of extinction, from which it was rescued by being merged with the Somerset House Lodge, founded by Dunkerley. The Goose and Gridiron Lodge No. 1 is the only one of the original 4 lodges now in existence. After various changes of names, it is now the Lodge of Antiquity No. 2, having lost its proud position of the first on the list when the lodges were renumbered by the casting of lots at the time of the union of the 2 rival Grand Lodges in 1813. It seems to have been a mixed lodge, part operative and part speculative, and this fact no doubt made for continuity and stability in its long history and service. Not much is known of the first Grand Master, Anthony Sayer, whose life seems to have been uneventful, if not unimportant, save for the accident, if we may call it such, of his election to the high office. About the only record of him, save the story of his ill fortune in later life, is to be found in Anderson's versions of the organization of the Grand Lodge in the 1738 edition of the Constitutions. Nothing is known of his previous history, except that he is described as a gentleman, in the old English meaning of the word, and that he was a member of the lodge meeting at the Apple Tree Tavern. He was a warden of his house, of his lodge, in 1723. Apparently he had never been its master, or if so, there is no record of it. Sayer served as Grand Master for 1 year, and in June 1718 was followed by George Payne. He was made Grand Senior Warden in 1719. Later he fell upon evil days never, it would seem, having been a man of much influence or position in the world, and more than once was aided by the craft over which he was the first to preside. He became Tyler of Old King's Arms Lodge, No. 28, and it's reported in the records that he was assisted, quote-unquote, out of the box of this society. He was also aided by Grand Lodge, in spite of some kind of irregular conduct of which he was accused in 1730, the nature of which is not known, for which he was called to account by Grand Lodge. The finding amounted to a verdict of not guilty, but don't repeat the offense. And Sayer did not again approach Grand Lodge for aid until 1741, when he received help. After that, one finds no allusion to him in the records of Grand Lodge or anywhere else until his death the following year in 1742, which was announced in the London papers, both in the Champion and in the Evening Post. From these accounts we learn that his funeral was attended by a great number of gentlemen of that honorable society of the best quality, and that he was buried in St. Paul's Church, Covent Gardens, where his widow was buried a few months later in the same year. The vague impression of Sayer that is left us, almost too vague to be perceptible, is that of an amiable but rather ineffective man rescued from utter oblivion by the one brief honor of his life. Hardly more than a name. No biography of his has been written, and no materials for one exist, if indeed so obscure and colorless a man deserved to be celebrated at all. Shortly after his death, probably in 1744, a portrait of Sayer was painted by Joseph Highmore, which was engraved by John Faber, a Dutch artist, both men of the craft, as an appendix to a Masonic history in which Highmore was interested. Bromley, in his catalogue issued in 1793, assigns the year 1750 as the date when the picture was published, with the legend, quote-unquote, Anthony Sayer, Gentleman, Grandmaster of Masons. Of this engraving, many copies have come down to us, which are highly prized as giving us the only image and likeness of the first ruler of our gentle craft. So much for the first Grand Master, of whom we know so little, not even the place or date of his birth. It is plain that the real work of the Grand Lodge in those critical and creative years was done by other and stronger men. They wrought well, but, excepting Anderson, and less certainly Desaguliers, we know very little of what part each took in the work. Nor does it greatly matter, as it is the building and not the builders that is the goal of our labors. And it is an eloquent fact that Masonry, even in its modern form, which took shape in the first Grand Lodge, is a cooperative enterprise in which no names outtop their fellows. Let us be grateful that it is so, remembering the wisdom of Goethe, one of the greatest men in the annals of our craft, who, as he grew older, took comfort in the beautiful feeling that entered his mind that only mankind together is the true man, and that the individual can only be happy when he has the courage to feel himself in the whole and lose himself in it. All right, I hope you guys enjoyed that paper. We'll continue with the third and final bit of it next week. I hope you guys all tune in. Now comes the point in the show where I ask you to help support this show. How do we do that? Well, we have a bunch of different ways to do that today. If you head on over to WCYpodcast.com, you can click on direct donation through PayPal, which we briefly touched on in the beginning of the program. Of course, you can make that one-time donation, or you can sign up to be a monthly contributor. Contributing $2 a month, $5, or even $10 a month, whatever you choose, really helps the program out. Of course, we have a limited edition shop where you can pick up any number of items that come direct from us. Help us out by going to MasonicRevival.com, but also we have some other affiliates that are really important. Banker's Best, one of the most unique things we've ever done, is to work with Brother Levi Banker out of St. Louis, who owns his own company called Banker's Best Beard and Skincare. He's been so generous. If you head to WCYpodcast.com, click on More, then click on Banker's Best, and you can check out a bunch of the different products he's got. He's got a whole line of beard care products, skin care, oils, balms, all of this stuff, and he has been doing it a long time. He knows a lot about it. Everything is handmade, quality items. We even came up with the King Solomon's Reserve Beard Balm, which is a few years old now, but remains one of the great products that he still offers. Even the artwork on the bottle was done by a brother. The nice thing about this particular product is 50% of the proceeds come back to the program. If you're a history guy like me, then you'll be pleased to know that what makes the beard oil and balm very special is that it was made utilizing the fragrances specific to the exports of King Solomon's time and location, which is amazing. So black fig and honey is the formula. Luxurious scent, as Levi says, truly fit for our first Grand Master. If you use the promo code BBWCY357 at checkout, you'll also get a little bit of a percentage off. Please check that out. Banker's Best, or just head on over to buybankersbest.com. We also have a code with Onnit. You can go to our website, click on More, then go to Onnit, and you can click through any of the links here, or just go to Onnit.com and use the promo code WCY at checkout. You'll get 10% off, and they'll send a little bit back to the program to help us out. And of course, it's business time. The book that I wrote with John T. Ruark, it is making some real waves, and people are using it and seeing success. So check that out on Amazon. You can click right to it. You can get it on Audible, Kindle, or in print, even on iBooks. And last but not least, I want to ask you to check out the Great Books program. You'll see the banner for it on the left-hand side, Intellectual Linear Progression. Use the promo code WCY, or you can just click on that link there, and you'll actually go right to the website and hear a little bit from Scott Hambrick about how awesome the program is. So that's it. I hope you guys enjoy, and thank you so much for helping us out. All right. Now, the next piece for this week is called The Worthies of Freemasonry, Solomon, the Founder of the Temple. Quote, Solomon was the heir of David, and he said, quote, Mortals, I understand the song of the birds. I possess every kind of knowledge. I have been raised to the sublime height. End quote. Al-Quran of Muhammad. If the lives of Enoch and Noah have presented any topics of interest to the Masonic reader, that of King Solomon must claim his attention in a still greater degree, for the most important events of this monarch's career were so very intimately connected with the very foundation of Freemasonry that the craft may have not thought him unworthy of the honorable title of the first most excellent Grand Master. They look upon him with reverence as their great and wise lawgiver and still submit with passive obedience to what they suppose to have been his will and his directions in the organization of the institution. Solomon, the king of Israel, the son of David and Bathsheba, ascended the throne of his kingdom 2,989 years after the creation of the world and 1,015 years before the Christian era, according to biblical texts and evangelical teaching. He was then only 20 years of age, but the youthful monarch is said to have commenced his reign with a decision of a legal question of some difficulty, in which he exhibited the first promise of that wise judgment in which he was ever afterwards distinguished. One of the great objects of Solomon's life, and the one which most intimately connects him with the history of the Masonic institution, was the erection of a temple to Jehovah. This, too, had been a favorite design of his father. For this purpose, that monarch, long before his death, had numbered the workmen whom he found in his kingdom, had appointed the overseers of the work, the hewers of the stones and the bearers of burdens, had prepared a great quantity of brass, iron, and cedar, and had amassed an immense treasure with which to support the enterprise. But on consulting with the prophet Nathan, he learned from that holy man that although the pious intention was pleasing to God, yet that he would not be permitted to carry it into execution. And the divine prohibition was proclaimed in these emphatic words, quote, Thou hast shed blood abundantly and hast made great wars. Thou shalt not build a house unto my name, because thou hast shed much blood upon the earth in my sight. The task was therefore reserved for the more peaceful Solomon, his son and successor. Hence, when David was about to die, he charged Solomon to build the temple to God as soon as he should have received the kingdom. He also gave him directions in relation to the construction of the edifice, and put it into his possession the money amounting to 10,000 talents of gold and 10 times that amount of silver, which he had collected and laid aside for defraying the expense. Solomon had scarcely ascended the throne of Israel when he prepared to carry into execution the pious designs of his predecessor. For this purpose, however, he found it necessary to seek the assistance of Hiram, king of Tyre, the ancient friend and ally of his father. The Tyrians and Sidonians, the subjects of Hiram, had long been distinguished for their great architectural skill, and in fact, many of them as the members of the Mystic Operative Society, the fraternity of Dionysian artificers, had long monopolized the profession of building in Asia Minor. The Jews, on the contrary, were rather more eminent for their military valor than for their knowledge of the arts of peace, and hence King Solomon at once conceived the necessity of invoking the aid of these foreign architects if he expected to complete the edifice he was about to erect, either in a reasonable time or with the splendor and magnificence appropriate to the sacred object for which it was intended. For this purpose he addressed the following letter to King Hiram. Quote, Know thou that my father would have built a temple to God, but was hindered by wars and continual expeditions, for he did not leave off to overthrow his enemies till he made them all subject to tribute. But I give thanks to God for the peace I at present enjoy, and on that account I am at leisure and design to build a house to God, for God foretold by my father that such a house should be built by me. Wherefore, I desire thee to send some of thy subjects with mine to Mount Lebanon to cut down timber, for the Sidonians are more skillful than our people in cutting wood. As for wages to the hewers of wood, I will pay whatever price thou shalt determine. End quote. Hiram, mindful of the former amity and alliance that had existed between himself and David, was disposed to extend the friendship he had felt for the father to the son, and replied therefore to the letter of Solomon in the following epistle. Quote, It is fit to bless God, that he hath committed thy father's government to thee, who art a wise man, and endowed with all virtues. As for myself, I rejoice at the condition thou art in, and will be subservient to thee in all thou sendest to me about. For when my subjects, I have cut down many and large trees of cedar and cypress wood, I will send them to sea, and will order my subjects to take floats of them, and to sail to what place soever of thy country thou shalt desire, and leave them there, after which thy subjects may carry them to Jerusalem. But do take care to procure us corn for this timber, which we stand in need of, because we inhabit in an island." Hiram lost no time in fulfilling the promise of assistance which he had thus given, and accordingly we are informed that Solomon received 33,600 workmen from Tyre, besides a sufficient quantity of timber and stone to construct the edifice which he was about to erect. Hiram sent him, also, a far more important gift than either men or materials, in the person of an able architect, a curious and cunning workman, whose skill and experience were to be exercised in superintending the labors of the craft, and in adorning and beautifying the building. Of this personage, whose name was also Hiram, and who plays so important a part in the history of Freemasonry, we shall have occasion in our next article to speak more particularly. King Solomon commenced the erection of the temple on Monday, the second day of the Hebrew month of Ziph, which appears to the 21st of April in the year of the world 2992 and 1012 years before the Christian era. Advised in all of the details, as Masonic tradition informs us, by the wise and prudent counsels of Hiram king of Tyre and Hiram Abiff, who, with himself, constituted at that time the three grand masters of the craft, Solomon made every arrangement in the disposition and government of the workmen, in the payment of their wages, and in the maintenance of concord and harmony, which should ensure dispatch in the execution and success in the result. That no confusion might arise in consequence of the great number employed, which has been estimated by some writers at not less than 217,281, the workmen were divided into three classes, distinguished by their different degrees of proficiency and skill. To each of these classes, peculiar signs and words of recognition were entrusted, and of each distinct duties and labors were required. The most admirable methods of paying the craft were adopted, so that every possibility of imposition on the part of the craftsmen, or of injustice on that of the rulers, was easily avoided. All the stones were hewn, squared, and numbered in the quarries of Tyre, and the timbers felled and prepared in the forests of Lebanon, whence they were carried by sea on floats, as King Hiram had promised, to Joppa, and thence by land to Jerusalem, where they were deposited and secured in the appropriate places by wooden mauls, so that as Scripture, as well as Masonic tradition informs us, quote, "there was neither hammer nor axe nor any tool of iron heard in the house while it was in building," end quote. Another tradition seeks to impress upon our minds the favor with which the undertaking was viewed by the deity, by affirming that while the building was in progress, it did not rain in the daytime, lest the workmen should be interrupted in their labors. To Hiram Abiff was entrusted the general superintendence of the building, while subordinate stations were assigned to other eminent artists and masons. Their names and offices have been handed down in the traditions of the order. Adoniram, who is said to have been the brother-in-law of Hiram Abiff, appears under the title of inspector to have held the next position in dignity to that illustrious personage. We are informed that he commanded the workmen at Jerusalem at their first organization before the arrival of Hiram Abiff, and that afterwards he had the inspection of the works at Mount Lebanon, where the monthly levy of 10,000 Jews in connection with the Tyrian craftsmen were employed in the preparation of timbers. Tito Zadok, the high priest and prince of Herodim, or nobles, was appointed to control the 300 architects who were appointed to superintend the disposition of the materials, and at the same time, Solomon instituted a school of architecture for the instruction of workmen, so that as the temple was advancing in its progress toward completion, the craft were augmenting their knowledge and experience of that, quote-unquote, royal art. Masonic tradition informs us that the Jewish workmen who were employed were divided into 12 classes according to their several tribes, and that 12 illustrious knights were appointed to render to Solomon a daily account of the work which had been done by their respective tribes. In short, the utmost perfection of human wisdom was displayed by this enlightened monarch in the disposition of everything that related to the construction of the stupendous edifice. Men of the most comprehensive minds, imbued with the greatest share of zeal and fervency, and inspired with the strongest fidelity to his interests, were employed as masters to instruct and superintend the workmen, while those who labored in inferior stations were excited to enthusiasm by the promise of promotion and reward. We do not lose sight, at this period, of the stone of foundation to which reference has already been made in the lives of Enoch and Noah. Tradition informs that coming into the possession of King Solomon with the knowledge of that ineffable name which was inscribed upon its surface, he took the securest precautions to preserve it from future destruction by accident, or from the pollution of unhallowed curiosity, by depositing it in a place of silence and secrecy, which, in a mode that we are not at liberty to explain, he caused to be constructed. While everything in relation to the temple was in this happy progress to completion, an event occurred of most lamentable nature, which at once threw the whole of the craft into confusion, suspended the works for a temporary period, and became a source of the deepest grief to King Solomon. An act of treachery was unexpectedly committed, which impaired for a time the harmony and order with which the undertaking had heretofore been conducted, and deprived the monarch of his most faithful friend and wisest counselor. But the judgment and decision for which Solomon had heretofore been distinguished did not desert him at this trying moment, and by a well-digested and admirably executed plan he succeeded in arresting the criminals and inflicting upon them that punishment which their crime so richly merited, while by the previous exercise of his prudence and sagacity he was enabled to prevent the irretrievable loss of that sacred symbol for the surreptitious possession of which the offense had been committed, and by means of that stone of foundation which had already been its conservator in the days of Enoch, to secure it for the discovery of future times. King Solomon, immediately after the death of his valued friends, made the necessary preparations to supply his place as far as it could possibly be accomplished. The ineffable degrees supply us with a large amount of information in relation to the means thus adopted by Solomon for carrying on the works of the temple. For this purpose, he instituted new degrees and appointed new officers, among whom he divided the labors that had formerly been executed by one man. The architectural work was placed under the control of several persons who were styled intendants of the building, and who were selected from among the class of architects who had been previously placed under the care of Tito Zadok, while the administration of justice was entrusted to another class, who were called provosts and judges. In this manner, the progress of the building continued uninterruptedly until its completion. The temple was at length finished in the month of Bull, answering to our November, in the year of the world 3000, being a little more than 7 years from its commencement. As soon as the magnificent edifice was completed and fit for the sacred purpose for which it was intended, King Solomon determined to celebrate the consummation of his labors in the most solemn manner. For this purpose he directed the ark to be brought from the king's house where it had been placed by King David, and to be deposited with impressive ceremonies in the Holy of Holies beneath the expanded wings of the cherubim. This important event is commemorated in the beautiful ritual of the most excellent master's degree. Our traditions inform us that when the temple was completed, Solomon assembled all heads of the tribe, the elders and chiefs of Israel, to bring the ark up out of Zion, where King David had deposited it in a tabernacle, until a more fitting place should have been built for its reception. This duty, therefore, the Levites now performed, and delivered the ark of the covenant into the hands of the priests, who fixed it in its place in the center of the Holy of Holies. It was during the construction of this edifice that we believe the system of Freemasonry to have been thoroughly revised and placed under its present organization. The great truths which had been preserved by Enoch and Noah and handed down through a long succession of patriarchs had, as we have already seen, been lost to the rest of the world since the time of the dispersion and confusion of the Tower of Babel. But the Tyrian workmen who arrived at Jerusalem in possession only of the dim and imperfect light which they had derived from what had been called the spurious Freemasonry of the pagan mysteries, were here at Mount Moriah on the threshing floor of Ornan the Jebusite, to recover their lost knowledge, and once more to find the universal language and the true doctrines of Freemasonry. The whole system of Freemasonry, says Arcadian Mont, quote, underwent some revisal under the command of Solomon, who, being acquainted with many of the most famous systems of mysteries instruction, was enabled from that knowledge to settle among the true believers an improved form of Masonic discipline, and from this point accordingly our present system of Freemasonry is undoubtedly to be dated. End quote. By the construction of this magnificent edifice, Solomon and the Masons engaged with him in the undertaking acquired immortal honor. The order was now firmly established and thoroughly regulated, and the wisdom of the illustrious founder became the theme of admiration to surrounding nations. It was this widespread reputation that induced the Queen of Sheba, a country supposed by most commentators to be situated in the southern part of Arabia, to visit Jerusalem and inspect the celebrated works of which she had heard so many encomiums. And Masonic lore informs us that, when she first beheld the stupendous edifice which glittered with gold and seemed from the accurate judgment of all its joints to be composed of but a single piece of marble, she raised her eyes and bands in an attitude of admiration and exclaimed, "Most excellent master." Here then the immediate and personal connection of King Solomon with the craft begins to draw a conclusion. It is true that be subsequently employed, those worthy masons whom, at the completion and dedication of the temple, he had received and acknowledged as most excellent masters in the erection of a magnificent palace and other edifices, but in process of time he fell into the most grievous errors, abandoned the path of truth, encouraged the idolatrous rites of spurious masonry, and induced by the persuasion of those foreign wives and concubines whom he had espoused in his later days, he erected a fane for the celebration of these heathen mysteries on one of the hills that overlooked the very spot in his youth he had consecrated a temple to the one true God. It is, however, believed that before his death he deeply repented of this temporary aberration from virtue, and in the empathetic expression, quote, "vanity of vanities, all is vanity," end quote, he is supposed to have acknowledged that in his own experience he had discovered that falsehood and sensuality, however they may give pleasure for a reason, will in the end produce a bitter fruit of remorse and sorrow. That King Solomon was the wisest monarch that swayed the scepter of Israel has been the unanimous opinion of posterity. So much was he beyond the age in which he flourished in the attainments of science that the Jewish and Arabic writers have attributed to him a thorough knowledge of the secrets of magic by whose incantations they suppose him to have been capable of calling spirits and demons to his assistance. And the Talmudists and Mohammedan doctors record many fanciful legends of his exploits in controlling these ministers of darkness. As a naturalist, he is said to have written a work on animals of no ordinary character, which, however, perished, while his qualifications as a poet were demonstrated by more than 1,000 poems which he composed, of which his Epithalamium on his marriage with an Egyptian princess and the Book of Ecclesiastes alone remain. He has given us in his Proverbs an opportunity of forming a favorable opinion of his pretensions to the character of a deep and right-thinking philosopher. While the long peace and prosperous condition of his empire for the greater portion of his reign, the increase of his kingdom in wealth and refinement, and the encouragement which he gave to architecture, the mechanic arts, and commerce testify his profound abilities as a sovereign and statesman. After a reign of 40 years he died, and with him expired forever the glory and the power of the Hebrew Empire. But the masons whom he had instructed and organized, dispersing into various countries in search of employment, carried with them the most grateful remembrance of his wisdom and his youthful virtues, and conveyed to the remotest lands the blessing of the noble institution that he had founded, in which, lost by the wickedness of his ancestors at the Tower of Babel, was by his piety again discovered on the threshing floor of Ornan the Jebusite. Extracted from the Masonic Review, 1856. Just a quick review of this paper. I think it's a really good paper. It's a wonderful amalgamation of several different evangelical and biblical accounts. I think there should be some great pause at certain parts in this paper that we need to be careful with, because this seems to give us the idea that this is based on fact and all of this, but really, especially where it comes into talking about how Freemasonry definitely came from this particular brand that was espoused by King Solomon, and so on and so forth, where the author tends to connect a lot of these ideas as best possible to his Christian faith, we do need to remember that, in actuality, objective looking at this as it is, we know that the mysteries came from likely Egypt, were then brought into Greece by way of conquering and all of these things, and then kind of worked their way through, and every religion or every culture puts their spin on them until we get eventually to where they were gone. And then we have the Renaissance followed by the Enlightenment, and the Enlightenment really sought to put these degrees together in such a way that they spoke to the antiquity of sorts, but not to be confusing allegory with factual pieces of information. And those people who wrote these degrees understood that, and many guys don't understand that after them or even today. But it's important to realize those things, that this is all allegory, it's a story, it's a tale as old as time, as they say, and really just is changed from one culture and religious system to the next. And when we dive down to the deep center of all of this, there is a single piece of knowledge that we can discern from, and it's the thing that keeps getting passed from organization to organization, from culture to culture, religion to religion, and it's the same. So it's just important to remember those things. But I hope you guys enjoyed the paper nonetheless. But that's it for this week. So again, just want to thank everybody out there who goes ahead and helps us out with the forming of this program. Get yourself the brand new producer's pin, which will be available very soon. You can pre-order it right now on our website, wcypodcast.com. If you have questions, comments, concerns, shoot me an email, wcypodcast@gmail.com. I'm pretty much always working, so just know that if you do write and I take a while to respond, I will respond eventually. If you enjoy Freemasonry and you enjoy this podcast, please consider joining us on the Masonic Roundtable, where we go live every Thursday at 9:30, 8:30 Central. That's right, we changed days and times, but we're still on the same channel. So check us out there Thursday night, 9:30 Eastern, 8:30 Central, and interact live with us on YouTube. That's always fun. Last week, we had a great conversation about how to charter lodges in our various states, and it was a lot of fun. So check it all out. I hope you enjoy. Please make sure you're checking out the Midnight Freemasons, where we publish 3 articles every single week, Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays. With that, I'll take up no more of your time, brothers and friends. We'll talk to you all next week. Until then, stay on the level. For Whence Came You, I'm Robert Johnson.
Listening to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry with your host, Brother Robert Johnson. Be sure to join us for our next edition.